regarding this subject. And in this tradition, the Lady Fatima says that I asked the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said the following to me, Ya Fatima, man salla alayki ghafarallahu lahu wa alhaqahu bi haythu kuntu min al-jannah. This is a very nice tradition. It says that the Holy Prophet Muhammad said the following to the Lady Fatima. He said, O Fatima, if somebody sends his salutations and benedictions upon you, God Almighty will forgive him of his sins, and he will, after this person dies, he will allow him to join me wherever I am in heaven. We as Muslims who live after the, you know, era of the Prophet, and especially in the time of the occultation of the 12th Imam, we're not blessed with being in the physical presence of the Prophet Muhammad or his or any of his sons, his family members. So one of the great aspirations of all Muslims in this era is to see the Prophet, to meet the Prophet, to be with the Prophet and be in his physical presence. A lot of times people will ask, is there any way to see the Prophet in a dream? Or a lot of times people will ask, what did the Prophet look like? Or how was he? You know, we even have books written by a lot of our ulama regarding the shama'il or the characteristics of the Prophet, how he was physically, what did he look like? You know, these are very popular. So a lot of times people ask, is there any way to join the Prophet in heaven and meet him? One of the ways that we can answer this question is, say, by being kind and respecting his family. Right? You know, there's a famous tradition from the Prophet in which he describes Lady Fatima as a part of him. Biz'atum minni. Right? He says that the Lady Fatima is a part of me. And if somebody hurts her or angers her, it's like he has angered me. Conversely, as we see in this tradition, the Prophet says, if somebody respects the Lady Fatima, honors her, shows his respect to her, shows his admiration for her, then God Almighty will forgive him of his sins and allow him to be with him on the Day of Resurrection and also in heaven where he is. Right? And this shows us also, it's such a small task of sending our, such a small deed, which seems so insignificant, can have such a virtuous reward and such a great reward of us allowing us to meet the Holy Prophet in heaven. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the virtue of sending the benedictions and salutations upon the Lady Fatima. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
In the limelight.
Like Trump, Boris Johnson has been especially effective in normalizing the scurrilous and norm-shifting aspects of radical right discourse, says Graham McPhee, author, in an article published under the heading Neoliberalism is Normalizing Extreme Right Discourse in the UK. Stay tuned for more. One of the most familiar tactics of populist demagogues when under pressure is to shift the agenda away from reality and into a fantasy world of accusation, smears, false equivalences, and conspiracy theories. This erodes the boundary between the civil and uncivil, resulting in what scholar Ruth Wodak calls the shameless normalization of far-right discourse and ideas. As Wodak explains, the boundaries of the sayable are shifted, and traditional norms and rules of political culture, of negotiation and deliberation are violated by continuous provocations. Hoping to change the media conversation after a damning report on COVID rule-breaking within his administration, Conservative Prime Minister Boris Johnson swiftly deployed this tactic by smearing his chief parliamentary accuser, Labour Party leader Keir Starmer. The slur centers on the baseless and discredited claim that Starmer had protected from prosecution one of Britain's most notorious paedophile predators, this great celebrity Jimmy Savile. This untruth has its origins in the murky world of far-right conspiracy theory, and its endorsement by the Prime Minister has emboldened extremists. Most damning of all has been the condemnation by Savile's victims, relayed by lawyer Richard Scorer, who represented many of them. I can confirm that these allegations against Sir Keir Starmer are completely unfounded and unjustified, Scorer states unequivocally, adding that weaponizing the victim's suffering to get out of a political hole is disgraceful. Johnson's attempt to defend the false allegations suggests a level of a strategic purpose and political calculation, although he may have miscalculated this time. Polling remains dire, while support for Johnson among conservative legislators is ebbing as key aides resign. The jury is still out, and international events may yet give Johnson a reprieve. But if his premiership eventually crashes and burns, there is a danger that the problems this scandal reveals are personalized and localized. The contemptible nature of the smear and the Johnson's attention-grabbing personality encourage the tendency to see the rot only in this particularly bad apple, and the danger to democracy only in a certain style of political pantomime and a scurrilous discourse. Longer-term tendencies, social and institutional structures, and the cohorts of forerunners, allies, and enablers thereby go unnoticed. Recent political experience in the United States can be illuminating here. To an even greater extent, the oxygen-sucking presence of Donald Trump has focused attention on a single figure as the crux upon which the threat to U.S. democracy depends. But as a number of scholars have noted, the trends leading up to the present are deep-seated and still operative, and the coalitions invested in anti-democratic outcomes are more widespread than any single current or personality. In short, the anti-democratic slate is as much a function of the normal way things have been ticking over for decades as it is of moments of crisis, emergency, or the exceptional. In Britain, while Brexit certainly supercharged an antagonistic nativist politics that normalizes extreme right ideas, this tendency did not begin there. Xenophobic and authoritarian ideas that draw on and feed into the worldview of the radical right have been driving key government initiatives for decades. We'll be right back. In 2012, the Conservative Liberal Democrat Coalition launched its hostile environment policy, a dizzying array of measures explicitly designed to make life so unbearable for undocumented migrants that they would voluntarily choose to leave. These policies culminated in the Windrush scandal, whereby an estimated 15,000 British citizens of Caribbean descent were wrongly classified as illegal immigrants, with devastating consequences. Families were separated, people lost their jobs and homes, and many were detained and threatened with being deported to countries they barely knew. The message being sent appears quite clear. Britain's problems are the result of alien invaders, and those invaders are most likely non-white. And in 2003, the then Labour government launched the Prevent Strategy, a post-9/11 initiative ostensibly aimed at preempting radicalization and preventing homegrown terrorism, widely perceived as targeting British Muslims as a suspect community. The program has been criticized not only as counterproductive, but also for creating the potential for systematic human rights abuses and an increased risk of discrimination. And there is much more of a similar vein in the pipeline. Legislation currently going through Parliament includes a new borders and nationality bill that breaches international law and which arguably creates a second-class, precarious version of citizenship for those with ties to other countries and unable to claim exclusively British descent. An elections bill on the GDP model imposes new and unnecessary obstacles to voting, which in the judgment of one of the governing party's own members of parliament, risks undermining one of the most fundamental rights we have here in the UK to vote freely without restriction. Meanwhile, the new policing and crime bill threatens to significantly erode the right to freedom of assembly and peaceful protest. In each case, the legislation is designed to pick apart the paradigm of universal democratic citizenship, which is meant to be open to all citizens regardless of race, ethnicity, social class, or political affiliation. Instead, they privilege a national population, the supposedly real English people, as opposed to ethnic outsiders and the cultural elites who are said to despise the nation. And it is this long-term build-up of a populist, common-sense nativism that represents the most fundamental mainstreaming of extreme-right norms and values. The dynamics driving this longer-term trend are complex, but a clue lies in the fact that its proponents include all the parties involved in government since the turn of the millennium. Labour and Liberal Democrat, as well as Conservative, for example, the origins of the hostile environment policy lie in the anti-immigrant crackdown under the new Labour administration in 2007. This speaks to the larger political shifts associated with the cementing of the neoliberal consensus since 1980s in Britain and globally. Neoliberalism, the ideology of privatization, financialization, and labor precarity, not only generates record levels of income and wealth inequality, but also leaves an ideological vacuum by jettisoning the element of redistribution once central to social democratic policies. As political philosopher Nancy Fraser has argued, the easiest way to compensate for this absence is to stress the elements of recognition in politics those culturally defined makers of esteem, status, and identity. And because extreme right ideas focus on the identity of majority of demographics through populist nationalism and resentment at perceived cultural disesteem, neoliberal politics finds a particular affinity there. According to Fraser, this affinity has been particularly strengthened in the UK and the US because under Tony Blair's New Labour and Bill Clinton's New Democrats, neoliberal economics was initially associated with a progressive model of recognition. The discourses of multiculturalism and gender equality that are now pilloried as politically correct or woke. Successful at the time, the center-left has bequeathed a legacy that for many seems to combine the worst of both worlds. While presiding over the collapse of secure employment, these administrations were perceived as sneering at the cultural norms and traditional values of the working class and the blue-collar middle class. For this reason, although governments of every stripe have implemented neoliberalism, it is the center-left that is perceived to have sided with the elites and betrayed ordinary people. After 9/11, New Labour in the UK jettisoned its commitment to multiculturalism and cultural cosmopolitanism, adopting a nativist rhetoric that even the Conservatives denounced as borrowing from the extreme right. But without a different model of economic distribution, a real shift away from neoliberalism and a return to a revived social democracy, all that has been achieved is an even deeper normalization of extreme right discourse. And it is this tendency that subsequent conservative-led governments have pursued with relish. Like Trump, Boris Johnson has been especially effective in normalizing the scurrilous and norm-shifting aspects of radical right discourse. But the deeper threats to UK democracy, just as in the United States, will still need to be addressed once these divisive figures are gone.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بوعست لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. The Holy Quran says, لقد كرمنا بني آدم وحملناه في البر والبحر. Man has been created by Allah with special qualities and attributes that puts him on top of all other creatures in terms of importance, in terms of dignity, in terms of honor and respect. The verse which I recited, verse 70 of chapter 17, clearly indicates that man is a superior. We have honored the children of Adam and we have carried them in the land and the sea. And of course, we have given them to excel by an appropriate excellence over most of those whom we have created. Human beings have a God-given power of judgment and discrimination and conscience. These are qualities, these are the capacities Allah Almighty has placed in human beings. Everyone understands what is good and what is bad. Prophets were sent to make people aware and strengthen their powers of understanding. The prophets were the external messengers of Allah. We have the internal messenger, which is the intellect, and the external ones who are the prophets. The prophets were supposed to preach the message of Allah, to propagate the message of Allah. And that was to help humanity improve, to achieve perfection, to get closer to Allah. The prophets came to tell us that, for example, truth is good. Everyone must tell the truth, that honesty is good, generosity is good, lying is bad, treason is bad, treachery is bad. You know, these are the things many people, they had no idea of, for example, backbiting. Backbiting is so bad, you know. The religion of Islam and the Prophet of Islam said that backbiting is absolutely forbidden. It's just like eating someone's flesh, your brother's flesh. So everyone is aware that to lie is wrong. And this is the intellect, the human intellect, you know, also says. The prophets came to emphasize the difference between right and wrong. And also to tell that this is right and this is wrong. To just remind them of what's right and what's wrong. And the prophets also teach us things which we were not aware of. So there are some details which the human intellect cannot explore, cannot identify, cannot discern. The Quran says in chapter 91, verse 7, "And the soul and him who perfected it, then he inspired it to understand what is right and wrong for it." فَأَلْهَمَهَا فُجُورَهَا وَتَقْوَاهَا وَنَفْسِ وَمَا سَوَاهَا وَنَفْسِ وَمَا سَوَاهَا فَأَلْهَمَهَا فُجُورَهَا وَتَقْوَاهَا. It means that God inspired man and the human soul to understand what's right and what's wrong. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand there crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Man's success and man's prosperity, man's, you know, salvation depends on the soul. And his discrimination of good from bad is not enough. He should act on the knowledge he has been given by Almighty Allah. Man will never be satisfied by anything except by the remembrance of Allah. And by drawing closer to him. الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَتَطْمَئِنَّ قُلُوبُهُمْ بِذِكْرِ اللَّهِ أَلَا بِذِكْرِ اللَّهِ تَطْمَئِنُّ الْقُلُوبُ. Those who believe and whose hearts are set at rest by the remembrance of Allah. Now surely by Allah's remembrance are the hearts set at rest. Verse 28 of chapter 13. So every human being actually tries to reach his Lord, and some may not do so because man has been created free. He has the volition, he has the free will to choose not to make efforts to reach his Lord. You know, it depends on the individual himself. Different people might want to do different things because at the end of the day, everyone is supposed to be answerable to his actions, to his deeds, and every individual is held responsible for his activities, for his deeds. Everyone is held responsible for his good deeds, for his bads, for his mistakes, for his making efforts to reach God. Some people might want to get closer to Allah, get nearness to Allah. Some may not do it, you know. Some might want to acquire infinite wealth in this world, which is so insecure and so transient, this world. The only way to fulfill oneself is by making one's soul aware of Allah. That's very important. We should try to reach Him with full knowledge and be conscious of the goal we are trying to reach. O man, surely you strive to attain to your Lord, a hard striving until you meet Him. The Quran says, يَا أَيَّهَا النَّاسِ إِنَّكَ كَادِحٌ إِلَىٰ رَبِّكَ كَدْحًا فَمُلَاقِيهِ. Thank you. Brothers and sisters, there are different types of souls. The highest is the confidential soul, of course. In one of the previous episodes, we did talk about the different types of soul. But the highest, of course, is the nafs al-mutma'inna. Of course, the lowest one is nafs al-ammara. The nafs al-mutma'inna, or the confident soul, is the most perfect soul that obeys Allah to the extent that nothing can shake it. All the prophets and all the imams and the noble companions of the prophet, they were people with nafs mutmainna, you know. Like Imam Hussain alayhi salatu wasalam, whatever he was doing for the sake of Allah. So nafs mutmainna is not something for the imams only. Everyone can make efforts to achieve that perfection, to attain that level or that stage, where his nafs becomes, confident. And of course, in order to attain this level, we must be in remembrance of Allah in each second of our life, our worldly life. Every expression of our life, our ideas, thoughts, deeds, looks, actions, and whatever we do should, express Him rather than us. That's when we attain perfection. That's when we attain that degree or that stage of nafs mutmainna, that stage of the nafs, which is the stage of perfection. And, to conclude, I would say that having a confident heart depends on the remembrance of Allah, the glorification of His attributes of beauty and perfection. And this is the secret key to our ascendance, to our perfection and to the attainment of a station or the higher station or the ranks, And it's necessary for every individual to try to ponder the attributes of Allah's perfection, His greatness, and man will never be satisfied by anything except by the remembrance of Allah. That's it for this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash He knows. Every thought I have and every word I share He knows.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Months of intense negotiations in the Austrian capital Vienna to revive the 2015 Iran deal coming to an end. The dialogue faces a make-or-break moment in the coming days. A draft text of an agreement between Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, is almost complete. The diplomatic effort seems to be near a climax, but still the very few remaining gaps in the text are keeping the whole thing in limbo, and a final failure is still a possibility. There has been a flurry of diplomatic efforts in Vienna's Palais Coburg Hotel, the venue of the marathon negotiations. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said on Thursday that talks between Iran and the P4+1 are still ongoing, and no one can say that an agreement has been reached until all outstanding important issues are resolved. The Iranian foreign ministry spokesman said extra efforts are needed to resolve the remaining issues and that everyone is now focused on the final key steps. Meanwhile, Russia's chief negotiator in Vienna says the talks are unlikely to end in failure. Mikhail Ulyanov told reporters in Vienna on Thursday evening that the remaining issues are few but need to be addressed. Ulyanov's comments were echoed by Britain's chief negotiator in Vienna, Stephanie Alcock, who said the parties are very close to an agreement. The Iranian side insisted that the talks in the Austrian capital have to reach a good deal or there will be no deal at all. Negotiators in Vienna have been trying to find a way to remove American unilateral sanctions against Iran and allow the U.S. to return to the 2015 deal. The U.S. sanctions were imposed after the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in 2018. U.S. President Joe Biden has acknowledged that his predecessor's pullout was wrong. But Biden's words have done little to solve America's credibility problem that is largely blamed on Donald Trump. Tehran now says the sanctions must be removed in a verifiable manner, and Washington must offer guarantees that it will not abandon the agreement again. The United States has been dragging its feet so far, but Tehran says it will not back down from its red lines.
Iran can't go through the same thing again. I mean, in 2018, the U.S. unilaterally, abrogated the JCPOA, slapped on punitive sanctions. Iran had had 3.5 years of intense economic suffering, and it doesn't want to see that happen again. It doesn't want to sign some treaty. Only to see, to see the same thing happen either in, either later this year or in 2024 when, if Donald Trump is reelected.
Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, has warned that if the Vienna talks do not lead to a good deal, the current U.S. administration will feel defeated in the near future due to lack of timely use of diplomatic opportunities. As all eyes are on the venue of the talks in Vienna, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, will visit Tehran on Saturday to hold talks with Iran's nuclear chief and other top officials. The IAEA says the two sides will discuss outstanding safeguards issues with a view to addressing them. Does Grossi's trip boost the chances of a deal in Vienna? It is hard to guess at this point. The negotiations have been very complex, and there is no guarantee that they will end in a deal. It now seems that the fate of the diplomatic effort largely depends on whether the West will finally choose to make necessary political decisions.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has blamed the American regime for the current Ukraine crisis. He demanded an end to the war in Ukraine, saying the Islamic Republic of Iran has always opposed war and destruction anywhere in the world. The U.S. disrupted the stability of the country by interfering in its affairs and organizing rallies and creating a color coup. We oppose the killing of people and the destruction of the infrastructure of nations. Leader called the U.S. a perfect example and manifestation of modern ignorance, saying it feeds off the crises it creates all around the world.
Washington are glorified mobsters. That's all. America does to all of its allies. You've got to remember, there's a very good saying, if you're an American enemy, they might bribe you and bring you into their team. If you're their ally, good luck to you, sir.
Ayatollah Khamenei is referring to years of U.S. meddling in Ukraine since it became an independent state in the 1990s. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. pledged not to expand NATO eastward close to the borders with Russia. But the U.S. and its Western allies reneged their pledges and started to include more Eastern European countries into the Western military alliance. In 2014, the U.S. implemented a color revolution in Ukraine. and overthrew its democratically elected government. U.S. also supported the inclusion of right-wing groups and elements within Ukraine's government. It's now widely believed that in trying to move Ukraine into their orbit, Washington and its European allies overextended themselves, and Russia's intervention, firstly in facilitating Crimea's reunification with Moscow in 2014, then with the official recognition of the independence and sovereignty of the People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk, and now with a wider military operation to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine, is the result. Elsewhere, in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said there are lessons to be drawn with regard to the Ukraine crisis. He said Western powers cannot be trusted and their support for their puppet regimes is only, quote, a mirage. Iran's leader said both Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani have acknowledged that the U.S. simply abandoned them amid their domestic crises. As the crisis unfolded in Ukraine, the country's president, Zelensky, rude being left alone by the West. The U.S. has refused to send in soldiers to the country to protect its people and has only pledged more money and weapons.
Well, the Ukrainian president was basically helped into power by American advisors and American campaign organizers. The Ukrainian president was told that he could go ahead and put down by force the Donbass ethnic Russians who revolted after the government in Ukraine banned their language and restricted their ethnic autonomy.
The same scenario happened in Afghanistan, when after 20 years of occupation, the U.S. disastrously pulled out of the country, leaving President Ghani and Afghan people alone in the face of Taliban fighters. The U.S. is facing backlash over its treatment of its Arab allies. Despite selling them weapons worth billions of dollars and pledging support, it has failed to provide them with sustainable security.
More desperate. They put you in a more serious situation than you were before, and the terms that they dictate to you are much, much more demanding than it would have been had you not taken the actions that they allowed you to take at the first. So Zelensky took actions against his own ethnic Russian citizens at the bidding of the United States, at their will.
It's now become apparent that the failure of successive U.S. presidents and their European allies since the end of the Soviet era has been to overestimate their own power and underestimate that of Russia, China, Iran, and other countries that are outside their sphere of influence.
Both Ukraine and Russia have suffered damage and casualties since Moscow's self-declared special military operation began on Thursday. Bombardment and shelling of Ukrainian cities continued on Monday. According to officials in Kiev, the Russian military struck Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, possibly killing dozens of civilians. But the Russian officials dismissed the reports of civilian deaths as not credible and part of a propaganda campaign launched by the West. The West has responded to the conflict by imposing several rounds of unprecedented sanctions on Russia, targeting its media outlets and its financial, banking, and energy sectors, among others, prompting Moscow to retaliate some of the measures. Russia says it will ride out the sanctions. The first Ukraine-Russia meeting in Belarus to reach a ceasefire concluded on Monday, with parties discussing the possibility of holding a second round of talks. Russia says it aims to, quote, denazify and demilitarize Ukraine. It also says NATO must withdraw from areas along or near Russian borders and that the West must formally recognize Moscow's control over the Crimean Peninsula.
The Russians are looking at this and seeing a redeployment of forces up to their borders from the Baltic states all the way to Korea, bellicose rhetoric coming out of Washington on a daily basis for 5 years now, and they have to know it's time for us to do something. President Putin said last week, you have a knife at our throat, we had to act. And that's the mentality there. It's entirely appropriate given the recent history and the long history of relations between the U.S., Russia, Germany, Poland, and the other players in this.
Crimea has been the point of contention between the West and Moscow since its repatriation to Russia following a referendum in 2014. The U.S. and its allies reject the outcome of the vote and consider the move as illegal. Russian President Vladimir Putin said to ensure its security, his country was left with no choice but to attack Ukraine. The country also says the conflict in its western neighbor roots back years.
This crisis broke out not as a result of the launch of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine, but much earlier, when for 8 years you turned a blind eye to the crimes perpetrated by the Ukrainian nationalists in Donbass. And again, today, you did not mention at all the suffering of the residents of Donbass.
The radical nationalists, according to Russian officials, are funded and aided by the West to create a buffer zone between the two sides. That comes on top of NATO's numerous war games near Russian borders, exercises the Kremlin has slammed as provocative. But those are not the only destructive measures the Western nations, especially the U.S., have taken. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from many international accords, including key treaties with Russia, and namely the Cold War-era Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, INF, and the Open Skies Treaty. The pacts were signed in the late 80s and early 90s as means to de-escalate tensions, risking to spiral into an all-out nuclear war.
The withdrawal of the U.S. from the INF and the Open Skies Treaty and all of that tend to undermine the kind of confidence that's required right now to avoid a war. That's the first thing that has to be considered. Secondly, is that in the absence of that treaty, of course, we can assume that one of the most violative of those treaty weapons are available or probably deployed and as close to Russia as possible. Russians, certainly, military planners have to assume that. And that, again, puts them on a hair trigger in terms of deciding whether or not to fire a defense against what looks like an incoming attack.
It appears we're getting there again. The president has ordered the military to put the nuclear deterrent forces on high alert, citing what he called unfriendly gestures made by the West. The French foreign minister had earlier warned that the bloc was a nuclear power. Although experts believe the threats about a nuclear confrontation are not to lose any sleep over, the fact of them being mentioned is worrisome to many. Washington says it doesn't want to be a part of a direct conflict with Russia. Why did it pick a fight with the power then, if it wasn't willing to face the music?
North Korea says it launched a missile on Sunday as part of developing a reconnaissance satellite system. The North has not elaborated on the type of rocket used in the test, but authorities in South Korea say it appeared to be a ballistic missile, fired from an area near Pyongyang toward the sea off its east coast. The launch was the eighth this year and the first since the end of January when North Korea fired off a record number of projectiles, including its longest-range ballistic missile since 2017. North Korea has ramped up its missile testing in 2022, announcing plans to bolster its defenses against the United States and evaluating restarting all suspended military activities. North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, had previously stated that his country's weapons development is necessary for self-defense in the face of hostile policies from the United States, including sanctions and joint military drills with South Korea. The North has also vowed to strengthen its nuclear capabilities by building more powerful atomic weapons. The exact size and strength of North Korea's nuclear arsenal are unclear. Some estimates say North Korea could have around 200 nuclear weapons by 2027. Pyongyang is believed to have tested nuclear weapons several times. It has also tested ballistic projectiles capable of reaching the United States. But why does North Korea need this expanding military program?
they learned their lesson, in essence. They learned that the United States can't be trusted, and it is willing to commit just horrific crimes against the Korean people to secure its own interests. And so North Korea doesn't want to end up the same way that Iraq is, the way Palestine is, the way Afghanistan is, because of U.S. involvement, U.S. intervention.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command said it was consulting with its allies, South Korea and Japan, about the latest test. The command said in a statement that the U.S. condemns the launch and calls on North Korea to refrain from further, quote, destabilizing acts. Following a series of North Korean missile launches, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has imposed sanctions against Pyongyang. Washington has also called on the Security Council to take action against several North Korean individuals and entities accused of violating resolutions that ban North Korea's projectiles and nuclear weapons development. North Korean citizens continue to suffer because of the sanctions. The World Food Program has estimated that 10.1 million North Koreans are suffering from food shortages. Also, the UN has acknowledged that the US-backed sanctions were at least partly responsible for North Korea's food and medicine shortages.
The US sanctions against Korea have been devastating. It has significantly hurt the living standard of the people in North Korea. But with that in mind, they have pushed forward. They have continued on despite the difficult situation that they've been dealt because of U.S. foreign policy. You see that in their scientific advancements. You see that in their rebuilding of the nation after the Korean War. And you're seeing that now as they continue since the Trump administration continue to build newer and improve upon previous models of nuclear warheads.
Despite the sanctions, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un is pursuing a plan for developing weapons that included hypersonic weapons, spy satellites, solid-fuel intercontinental ballistic missiles, and submarine-launched nuclear projectiles. Kim has intensified expanding his country's military capabilities since his diplomacy with former United States President Donald Trump ended without an agreement in 2019.
Well, I certainly hope that the U.S. is serious about improving relations, but I highly doubt it. I think perhaps the first thing that could be done is the U.S. removing its forces from South Korea, because you have to recognize that in a lot of ways, the Republic of Korea, or South Korea, is just a staging ground for U.S. and NATO forces to be right there on the demilitarized border of North Korea. And so if the U.S. is serious about improving relations, it should, in my opinion, completely withdraw from South Korea all forces.
Trump took unprecedented steps by initiating several rounds of dialogue with the North. However, Washington blew what Pyongyang called a golden opportunity.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir la'inir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajhum. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of the Commander of the Faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. When we want to apply justice to humanity and to humans and to a society, we said one of the key elements to that is to have a leadership in place. A leadership that maintains and that secures the rights of the people, thus justice is established. The Commander of the Faithful, Ali alayhi salam, he saw that khilafates, or rulership, or power, government, call it whatever you want, is the fact, it is the right of the people. And also he saw it that it is not permissible to compel a person to take the oath of allegiance, meaning election. You're free to elect or not to elect. Such compulsion can possibly be exercised in the public interest, but not in the interest of the ruler himself, which is a massive difference. When people decide not to elect, not to choose a person, it is because of their own interest, not for the interest of the ruler. So good relations can subside between the ruler and the subjects only when the people elect a ruler themselves and take the oath of allegiance to him voluntarily, which is something that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam did, and no one before him has did, and even the ones after him, they didn't either. One of the important factors that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam applied in terms of trying to apply justice to society is that he freely associated and mixed with the people, with the subjects, because at the end of the day, they elected him to serve them, not for him to serve his own personal endeavors, not for his own personal interests, not for him to accumulate wealth, not for him to get power. That goes contrary and contradicts election and power in the first place. Not only did he apply that to himself, but he also made it the norm when it comes to his officials and to his governors. So this was a noticeable act in the government of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam in order to establish justice. He recommended that the officials emphatically to respect the rights of the people. So every time he appoints a governor, the number one law that Amir al-Mu'mineen sets is the fact that the rights of people need to be respected, need to be maintained, and need to be applied. And he introduced a tradition, a way of governing that has never been applied when it came to governors, something that we could relate to today, but we don't see it applied. Something that we need today, but it's not applied. Where Amir al-Mu'mineen applied it himself. Now, before we look into this tradition and this way of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam in establishing his own governors, let us take a short break and then we will continue.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Just before the break, we were saying that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he introduced a new system, a new tradition, a way of living, you can say it, that when it comes to people and their governors, he made something very special, that every time he sends a governor to a city or to a place, doesn't matter whether it's small or big, he used to write a treaty that he hands to the governor. And that treaty contains and consists of a number of laws. And these laws are just to make sure that people and the governors get well together. So first, the ruler needs to make himself the public servant, that he works for the public, not vice versa. And the public, the subjects in return, they need to give their respect and obedience to that ruler who's trying to serve them. If this treaty is between the ruler and by the people, both parties accept, then all good and well. Amir al-Mu'minin, he used to ask his commanders and he used to ask his governors that when they go to the city, first and foremost, they would gather the people and they would read the treaty to them. And they say to them, okay, I'm here to serve you, 1, 2, 3, 4. And if people accept to begin with, all good and well. If not, then Amir al-Mu'minin would act differently and he would do something else. If any of the parties later on decides to violate this treaty, the commander of the faithful, he himself, he would punish the party that violates this treaty. So, for example, in the case of the governor himself not applying the rules of Amir al-Mu'minin and not going according to the treaty he signed with people, Amir al-Mu'minin would first and foremost, he would take that person out of the position of government and he would replace him with someone else. And if he has taken wealth of the people, if he has mismanaged the people, if he has usurped and punished and was oppressive to people, Amir al-Mu'minin would apply qisas to him. He would apply justice and retribution to that person. If people in return also violate the treaty, Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi would also speak to those people. So we can see that when Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi had appointed one of his governors to Basra, and that governor was doing what he was asked by Amir al-Mu'minin. But when Talha and Zubayr and Aisha invaded Basra and they punished that governor and they tried to harm him and kill him, Amir al-Mu'minin, he saw it as his duty to establish order once again, and he took his armies and marched towards Basra to make sure that this treaty that was violated is reinstated. And he done the same thing with Muawiyah as well. So this was the justice of the commander of the faithful that sadly we have not seen until today. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
IRIB English Radio.